Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And this week, we are pleased to offer a special welcome to folks outside the United States who are hearing Talking History for the first time in its entirety on The Voice of America. VOA will be airing us weekly at this same time and place on your dial. Once again, welcome to Talking History. And this week we continue with our three-part series on the ancient Romans, Livia, Agrippina, and Caligula. Agrippina is next in line, Agrippina the Younger to be exact, wife of the Emperor Claudius and mother of Emperor Nero. In a moment, Talking History's Eileen Dugan will discuss the life of Agrippina with her biographer, Anthony Barrett. And after that, Stephen Allen joins us to compare the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision, Lawrence v. Texas, a gay rights victory, to the famous civil rights case of 1954, Brown v. the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on October 27, 1787, an essay written by Publius was published in the New York Independent Journal. Publius was, in fact, the pen name of Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. The essay was the first in a series of 85 Federalist papers intended to promote ratification by New Yorkers of the proposed U.S. Constitution. As Federalists, Madison, Hamilton, and Jay believed that centralized government was the only way for both commercial and westward expansion. Strong national government, they argued, was key to negotiations with foreign countries, and only a national government could oversee the introduction of a national currency and free trade between states. But the people were uneasy about instituting a national government. A national government could become distant, tyrannical, and oppressive. Publius addressed these objections, demonstrating how the dangers of centralized government could be mitigated by distributing power throughout all government branches, in effect creating a system of checks and balances. The Federalist Papers seized public attention in all of the states, not just New York, and helped secure ratification of the Constitution by which we now live.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a study by researchers at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center of Astrophysics has ignited a fierce scientific and political debate that has spilled over into the U.S. Senate and could influence American energy policy and international relations. And all of this is over the weather in the Middle Ages. The consensus of top international researchers is that the 1990s were more likely the warmest decade of the millennium in the Northern Hemisphere, and that humans have probably caused much of the warming. But the Harvard-Smithsonian report, Proxy Climatic and Environmental Changes of the Past 1,000 Years, published in Climate Research by Willie Soon and Sally Balyunas, lets humanity off the hook. Its authors argue that the Middle Ages were warmer than the 20th century. Scientists and politicians who are skeptical about claims of global warming have trumpeted the assessment. Supporters of the concern for global warming have attacked it. And as to the evidence, because reliable thermometer recordings go back only as far as the 19th century, longer-term studies such as this rely on so-called proxy records, tree rings, sea sediments, and glacier layers, all of which track climatic variables. This is Talking History. The wife, sister, and mother of Roman emperors, but she gathered and exercised power of her own and in the process became infamous. just how much of that infamy was deserved is the subject of Eileen Dugan's conversation with her guest this week, Anthony Barrett.
Agrippina the Younger, if we are to believe the ancient historians, was an evil woman. The wife of one emperor, Claudius, and the mother of another, Nero, Agrippina allegedly schemed, killed, and slept her way to power, power that no woman in Rome should even have desired. But is this assessment of Agrippina accurate or fair? Was Agrippina the monster we are told she was, or was she the victim of misogynist writers? With us today to examine this notorious Empress of Rome is Dr. Anthony A. Barrett, Professor of Classics at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Barrett is the author of Agrippina, Sex, Power, and Politics in the Early Empire. Welcome, Dr. Barrett.
Hello.
Who was Agrippina the Younger?
Agrippina was the great-granddaughter of the first Roman emperor, Augustus, and the sister of the third Roman emperor, Caligula. So that in a nutshell, is her family background.
And how was she depicted in the ancient sources?
Well, the primary source for the Julio-Claudian period, the early emperors of Rome, is Tacitus. Tacitus was a man who belonged to the senatorial class, who had been ousted from power by the emperors, and so he was hostile towards the imperial system, and particularly hostile towards the imperial women, the wives and the sisters and the like, who interfered in what he considered already to be essentially an illegal system. So he had a natural bias against someone like Agrippina, and since Agrippina was a very forceful, ambitious woman, his hostility towards her was especially keen. This hostility, I have to say, though, is not limited to Tacitus. It's pretty well reflected in all of the ancient sources. The ancient histories, of course, the ones that have survived, were written by Roman men. They did not take kindly to the image of a woman holding power and influence in a very, very public fashion. In this way, Agrippina is in contrast with the first imperial wife, that's Livia, who exercised influence in the background. Agrippina did it very publicly and openly.
How did the ancient sources influence our modern interpretations of her?
Well, I think they influence us enormously. Although we like to feel that we're much more sophisticated in the way that we view women in politics, I think that we've still inherited the hostility of the ancient sources, and inherited it both directly from them and indirectly, in that they were the inspiration for things like I, Claudius, which reflects this very, very negative image of people like Agrippina.
How did being a woman limit Agrippina's options in the world of politics?
Well, in the Roman world, a woman had all sorts of privileges that they didn't enjoy for many generations afterwards, through the Middle Ages, many ways not until the 20th century, but they were not allowed to hold public office. So Agrippina, despite her powerful imperial lineage, she was an aristocrat, she was wealthy, she was obviously energetic and very, very able, she could not run for office. So as a consequence, if she wanted to have power and influence, she had to do it by influencing the men in her entourage.
So she was using her various female roles to get power? Could one say that?
If we believe the ancient sources, you would say that yes, she used her position as a woman. She used the ammunition that she could have as a woman to exercise power. We're told that she seduced Claudius, that Claudius was besotted by her, that Claudius was under her thumb. So this is the way the ancient sources would look at it. I don't see it that way myself. I see Claudius marrying Agrippina because she was a descendant of Augustus, which Claudius wasn't. Claudius was an outsider. He wasn't a direct descendant of Augustus and Julius Caesar. So Agrippina was a great asset to him, and I think that he used Agrippina as very much as a partner, as Augustus had done with Livia. The only difference is that that Agrippina made her partnership much more public. So I think that we have to divest ourselves of these the privileges that the ancients have. It's interesting that when women like Agrippina are described in the ancient sources, they're always described as beautiful, which we might think is a positive point. In fact, to the ancients, it wasn't. What they meant was that she was beautiful, therefore she could use her seductive charms for immoral ends.
Could one say that she stayed within her allotted spheres of daughter, sister, wife, mother, and yet still had political power?
Had Agrippina limited herself to the roles that you describe, mother, sister, wife, she could have had political power. In fact, she did have political power, but she could have continued to do that if she had been more careful about the way that she handled the public perception of this power. It does seem that that as sister of Caligula, she became involved in some sort of political conspiracy. We don't know the precise details, but it does seem that she conspired against Caligula. I think she was perhaps afraid that Caligula was going to be removed, as in fact that he was removed, but that this removal would bring down the whole imperial house, Agrippina with it. Under Claudius, she projected herself very, very much in the public arena. She appeared on coins. This was unheard of for the wife of an emperor to appear on official Roman coins. She did things like receiving foreign ambassadors, played roles of this sort that caused considerable offense. When her son Nero came to power, I think she just went too far and tried to be essentially a co-regent with her son. And I think at that stage she had really stepped completely out of the bounds of being simply the mother of the emperor. She was the mother of the emperor and in a way sort of co-emperor.
You've already mentioned her marriage to the Emperor Claudius, and the image that instantly comes to mind when thinking of Agrippina and Claudius is her giving him the poisoned mushroom.
Yes.
But you argue that she actually had a very positive influence upon his reign. How?
Well, we've talked about the way the ancient sources influence our view of the women. They also do it with our view of the men. We think of Claudius, I think we think of Derek Jacobi, you know, as this rather kindly, avuncular, slightly bumbling sort of man with all the best wishes of everyone in his heart. Claudius wasn't like that. Claudius was a shrewd and quite ruthless politician who was almost certainly involved in the murder of the assassination of Caligula. When he took power, he initiated what was close to a bloodbath, and for the first 7 or 8 years of Claudius's reign, we have a series of executions, prominent people put to death. When Claudius marries Agrippina, the situation changes. Now, I can't prove a direct causal connection, but it's quite striking that after from 48 onwards to the end of his life, Claudius really becomes a much more liberal, compromising kind of emperor. And so on that purely kind of statistical level, if we just look at the number of people who were punished, it is striking that there was a change after his marriage to Agrippina. When we look at the way that Agrippina got things done, it's very, very noticeable that she would do it by very, very careful preparation. She would She would win over individual members of the Senate, win them over to her side, and then they would present the case in the Senate. We find that in dealing with problems in Judea, that we find that there's a case where she, her advice is sought, and she intervenes and argues for a sort of reasonable, kind of balanced approach to the problem. So in all the instances where we have Agrippina interfering, we find that she's interfering with this indirect, conciliating, political way of doing things rather than just head-on confrontation, which had been the case before that. So I think in this sense, she was a restraining influence on Claudius.
You preface your book with a sort of rap sheet for Agrippina, listing her alleged lovers, her alleged victims. Did she really do all of that?
Well, it's very difficult to know what went on in Agrippina's private life. What we can say is that the ancient sources were very, very reluctant to give Agrippina credit for being energetic and able. So if she succeeded in influencing policy, if she succeeded in getting things done, how did she do this? Well, to the ancients, the explanation would be, well, she did this because she slept her way to the top. When she got to the top, she kept enemies at bay by murdering them. I think that we've got to be very, very cautious in accepting this kind of claim, in particular because, as I always tell my students, when if we look at a modern trial that deals with the issue of poisoning, we see how difficult it is sometimes to prove a poisoning case, to prove that a person was poisoned, to prove that that the accused person had administered the poison. Well, you think of the ancient world where there was no forensic medicine, no proper police force. All you had were hints and rumors. Very likely that a woman who would take on the role of looking after a sick husband or brother or the like, feeding them and the like, would get a reputation for being a poisoner if a large number of them died. And a large number did, but I think that's because they were eating food that was not properly preserved. The upper classes ate too much meat, and it was meat that they couldn't freeze, and meat that was doused in strong spices to cover the fact that it had gone rotten. So I think that a lot of these people died of food poisoning, and the women who'd looked after them got the blame for it. So I'd say treat these stories with great caution.
One thing that I think is for certain is that whether Agrippina did all the murders that were attributed to her, she was herself the victim of murder. How can you describe her death?
The death of Agrippina is, to me, one of the great mysteries of history. She, on her son's accession, she tried to control him. She failed, and Nero essentially banished her from public life. And she lived in sort of semi-exile. She lived out in her estates in Italy. And that went on for 5 years. And then, for some reason, after 5 years, Nero decided to murder her. And we don't really have an explanation for that. Now, it could be that she was maneuvering things in the background, that she had a lot of support in the imperial guard, that she was exploiting that support. We just don't know. So this is something of a mystery. And we're told there's a story that Nero invented a collapsing ship, which didn't quite work. I think I take this with a pinch of salt. But nevertheless, she escaped from this collapsing ship, swam to shore, and then Caligula dispatched assassins who clubbed and stabbed her to death. I really can't explain this. I think it might lie in deep psychological reasons. There are all sorts of stories about incest between Nero and Agrippina. Probably not true, but they do suggest someone who in his early years had been very, very close to his mother. We do know that after her death, that Nero would hear voices from the hills and have these terrible dreams of being pursued by avenging furies. So I think that Nero had a lot of psychological problems related to his mother. And he even had a mistress who looked just like his mother. And I think it must have been a situation of intense sort of love-hate that Nero was deeply attached psychologically to his mother and yet saw her as a political threat. And I think he may have agonized with that and then eventually decided that she had to be got rid of, that she was a political threat. But when he did that, he still found it very, very difficult to handle psychologically. I say this is something we're never going to know for certain.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today, but thank you, Dr. Barrett.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Anthony Barrett, professor of classics at the University of British Columbia and author of Agrippina, Sex, Power, and Politics in the Early Empire.
Once a demon cast a boy into a fire to destroy him. Demons can cast a person on the ground, causing him to wallow like an animal and foam at the mouth. But demons also have to come out when men of God, in the name of Jesus, command them to move. We're praying for a demon-possessed woman.
That
devil,
I don't want to.
You're coming
that.
Out.
I'm not going anywhere.
You're coming out of her.
I am not going anywhere.
You're coming out of her.
No,
you are.
No,
what makes you think you're not coming out?
I am not.
You are coming out.
No, I'm not bothering you.
I cast you out in the name of Jesus.
I'm not bothering you.
No, but you find this woman. You've got to let her go.
No, I won't.
You will let her go.
I will not.
This week is Halloween, and for our site of the week, we recommend to you a virtual site where you can learn more about the Salem Witch Trials. Here to tell you about it is Kelly Schrum of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
Witchcraft in Salem Village. The examination and confession of Mary Barker of Andover. She at last acknowledged that Goody Johnson made her a witch, and sometime last summer she made a red mark in the devil's book with the forefinger of her left hand. So begins the transcript of one of the accused in the Salem witch trials of 1692, available online at this useful and thorough website dealing with the Salem witch trials. The site provides a full-text version of the three-volume Salem witch trial transcripts, edited by Paul Boyer and Stephen Niesenbaum, as well as original court records, legal documents, contemporary narratives, pamphlets, and sermon excerpts. All of these works are searchable through a table of contents or an index that includes names of accused, as well as those who gave testimony, signed petitions, or offered pledges for the release of jailed witches. Five contemporary maps of Salem and nearby villages detail residences of accusers, accused, and witnesses. This website also provides access to more than 500 documents from the collections of the Essex County Court Archives, the Essex Institute Collection, and roughly 100 other documents at the Massachusetts Historical Society, Boston Library, and the University of Virginia Special Collections. These are somewhat difficult to navigate because the documents are linked via the archives rather than centrally on the main site, but it is worth the effort. Basic information on the history of Salem Danvers is complemented by images and brief descriptions of 14 public historical sites in Danvers. To locate this site, go to historymatters.gmu.edu, type Salem Village into the keyword search.
And finally, for our commentary of the week, Stephen Allen examines the claim by some that the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision, Lawrence v. Texas, has the potential to have as much impact on gay rights as the 1954 ruling in Brown v. the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas did on black civil rights.
When the Supreme Court ruled this June in Lawrence v. Texas that anti-sodomy laws were unconstitutional, Gay rights activists hailed the decision as a giant leap forward for their cause. Both activists and news commentators have compared this ruling to Brown v. Board of Education and its potential impact. But is this a valid comparison? In Brown, the justices held that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment applied to blacks as well as whites. Their decision overturned the 1896 Supreme Court ruling in Plessy v. Ferguson that the Constitution allowed for segregation. Plessy created the doctrine of separate but equal accommodations for blacks and whites. By the time of the Brown decision, it was obvious that the separate accommodations for blacks were hardly equal to those of whites. The Supreme Court went ever further than simply acknowledging that existing separate accommodations were unequal and ruled that separate treatment under the law is inherently unconstitutional. So did the Supreme Court make a similar decision in Lawrence v. Texas, ruling that unequal treatment of gays is unconstitutional? The justices were asked to dismiss the sodomy convictions of John Lawrence and Tyrone Garner on the basis of equal protection, but they chose to rule on the grounds that the right to privacy of the two men had been violated. While this ruling was good news for those who support the right to privacy, such as abortion rights activists, it was not a complete success for gays. In basing its ruling on the right to privacy rather than equal protection, the Supreme Court created a precedent that is more akin to Plessy than Brown. The Lawrence decision did not give gays all of the same rights as straight Americans, and it theoretically left the door open to certain types of discrimination. Lawrence v. Texas puts gays into a position like that created for blacks by Plessy v. Ferguson. While they are treated separately, they are by no means considered equals in all cases. For example, none of the 50 states recognize gay marriages, although that may soon change in Massachusetts. Vermont did create the category of civil union, which gives gay couples who wish to have their relationship officially recognized the same legal rights as straight married couples. A civil union is not, however, the same thing as a gay marriage. Vermont's law is clearly a case of separate but equal treatment. It took 58 years for the Supreme Court to advance from Plessy v. Ferguson's separate but equal doctrine to the equal protection granted by Brown v. Board of Education. The question is, will it take that long again?
You've been listening to Stephen Allen, an independent historian and a writer for the History News Service. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History and the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Our site of the week was produced by Amanda Schumann of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Rodopeus orbeus, tartareosque lacus tergeminunque canem, saxa tuo canto, vindex justissime matris, fecerunt muros officiosa novos, quandis mutus.